It is Tuesday, July 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, rescue teams in Thailand are evaluating the best ways of getting a youth football team and its coach out of a cave.
They've been without food and proper water for over a week right now.
How will President Donald Trump select his next Supreme Court nominee? We'll have a discussion. And Christian clergy in the United States have a range of opinions about immigration. It's all ahead. Thai officials say the threat of heavy rains has forced authorities to speed up their efforts to rescue 12 teenage football players and their adult coach who were found alive in a cave in Thailand 9 days after they went missing. The boys, ages 11 to 16, and their coach were found Monday on a ledge deep in the Tham Luang Caves. Reporter Steve Sanford is in Mae Sai on the Thai border near Myanmar, close to the cave region. He tells me about the reaction to discovering the team alive.
Well, I think a lot of people are excited and relieved. Last night, the announcement was made about 9:30 Thai time that they had found the kids. And that was the biggest concern, I think. It had been taking days to get through the water. There had been a lot of rain pretty much on a daily basis right now. It's sort of coming into the monsoon season in Thailand. So there would be dry spells and then it would be, you know, incessant rain. And so there's a lot of concern about the rain and the water levels. It was good that they managed. There was, I believe, a few English divers along with some Navy SEALs. And they reached the area just beyond where they thought the kids were going to be, which was an area called Pattaya Beach. The area is at the end of this long strip of caverns and corridors within the cave infrastructure. I mean, the families were elated. You can just imagine they've been basically camped out at this location on the mountainside for pretty much over a week already. And a lot of them, they hadn't slept for days, just immense stress, waiting to find out answers. And they got a lot of them last night. It was fantastic.
Now, however, they have to be rescued, but apparently this is a fairly, it sounds like, complicated process that they're going to have to go through. What are some of the complications facing the rescuers?
Well, I guess that's a very good point. I mean, the rising water levels, the fluctuating water levels is one of the concerns, because they're expecting to have more heavy rains coming soon. Okay, now at the same time, they've built more pumps into the area, and they've got a lot of water getting pumped out. So that is one of the concerns. Another concern would be the kids, the children's health. Okay, they've been without food and proper water for over a week right now. Their mental capacity they're probably in a pretty bad way in terms of, you know, how long they've been waiting in the dark. It's pitch dark. There's no light in that area at all. So, I mean, just to make the contact with them, I believe that is a huge, huge step. But as you say, they have to stabilize them. They have to make sure that they will be medically sound enough to make the path back down through the corridors and out of the cave. Now, people that got into the cave, these guys are experts. These guys have been doing emergency rescues and operations in different areas, quite a combined amount of experience between these groups that were going into the cave. So I think that it will take some time to stabilize the kids, get them healthy enough, strong enough, and then try to teach them some basics about going through the water. These waters, you know, they're murky, they're deep, and it's hard to navigate. But at the same time, there are things that they've been putting in place. They're putting in oxygen tanks every 25 meters. The other day, I saw the U.S. Air Force. They're unloading truckloads of these scuba gear air tanks. So they've been really getting prepared for this rescue operation, and it's going to take some time. It'll take definitely days, maybe weeks. You know, some people have said even months, but, you know, personally, I think it will take days. But just the fact that they have communication, they have the main contact with the rescue workers, with their families. I think that's a huge step in the right direction. I think it's going to end very successfully.
Is there any way they can get, say, medical personnel near these boys?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, they've got medically trained Thai workers as well as international staff that have come in. I mean, the other day I was walking around the site and there's people from Australia, Aussie Aid, AFP. The Chinese have brought in a crew of emergency rescue workers. And there is quite a large contingent of medical personnel. The other day they were doing a practice emergency evacuation. And they had basically 13 ambulances come into the area. And then they had the soldiers trained and the personnel to get them out of there. But again, I think the initial treatment would be when they get them in the cave to get them healthy enough and strong enough so that they can get out of there alive.
Steve Sanford reporting from Mae Sai on the Thai border with Myanmar. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Officials say the Trump administration will revoke Obama administration guidelines on race in college admissions. President Trump says the talks with North Korea are going well. Turkey warns against Syria against action against Idlib. And India demands Facebook curb the spread of false information on WhatsApp. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
An international group of astronomers have captured what is being called the first confirmed image of a planet forming near a young dwarf star. The group, led by scientists at the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Heidelberg, Germany, found the newborn planet making its way through a protoplanetary disk of dust and gas that surrounds a low-mass variable star called PDS 70. The young star is located in the Centaurus constellation and is about 370 light-years from Earth. Observational data suggests the still-forming planet called PDS-70b has a cloudy atmosphere and is about 3 billion kilometers from its host star, which is approximately the distance between our Sun and Uranus. The discovery of the planet and its image were made by the SPHERE instrument on the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope in Chile. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, President Trump and Mexico's new president-elect speak on the phone. President Donald Trump says he met with four very impressive candidates for the Supreme Court and will announce his nomination to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy on July 9th. White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Trump met with each candidate for roughly 45 minutes on Monday. When asked if Trump is looking for a candidate that will overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court ruling on abortion, Sanders reiterated Trump's stance that he's not asking the candidates their views on abortion rights. Trump has also said that his final list of potential Supreme Court nominees includes two women. Brandon Bartels is associate professor of political science at George Washington University. In the second part of our interview, I asked him about the significance of Roe v. Wade on Trump's high court choice as he meets with the candidates.
Nobody knows what goes on in these back rooms when a president is confidentially interviewing a prospective Supreme Court justice. Of course, we do know at Senate confirmation hearings, no nominee will state any position on any legal issues that will come before the court. So the Senate confirmation hearings do not provide much value in terms of prospective positions. The thing I would remind people about with respect to abortion is it's a precedent that has withstood the test of time. In 1992, when the Supreme Court revisited the abortion issue in a very significant case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which is the current law of the land on abortion, there were 8 Republican-appointed justices on that Supreme Court. And the one Democratic nominee was Justice Byron White, who actually dissented in Roe versus Wade. Everybody thought Roe versus Wade would be overturned in 1992, and the Supreme Court upheld the core ruling of Roe versus Wade that a woman has a constitutional right to an abortion. Now, they did scale back on the policy and gave states more latitude to regulate and restrict abortion, but still they upheld that core. So it's a precedent from a legal point of view and a legal doctrine standpoint. It's a precedent that has stood the test of time, and any court would be very hard-pressed to overturn that precedent. Again, they may scale it back and give the states more latitude to restrict, make restrictions on abortion. But in terms of overturning the core holding of Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, any court is going to be hard-pressed to do that, I would say.
Well, and also, what about the possibility that in the future, once President Trump makes his nomination and that person is approved, what about the possibility that Chief Justice John Roberts could become, I guess, the new swing voter for the Supreme Court?
And that's a live possibility that a lot of people, especially liberals, are hoping for at this moment. Conservatives are hoping that doesn't happen, of course. He has shown signs of deviating from the conservative party line, if you will. He has voted to uphold the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature domestic achievement, on two occasions. And he's joined the liberal coalition of justices on a couple of other occasions. He's also made it very well known that one of his most important roles as Chief Justice of the United States is to enhance the Supreme Court's legitimacy or rightful authority in the political system and to prevent attacks on its authority. He was had a famous interview in The Atlantic in 2007 where he talked about this and the need to reach consensus on the court. And of course, he voted with the liberals to uphold President Obama's Affordable Care Act, as I mentioned, in 2012. So there is the question of whether, in an effort to enhance or protect the court's authority in the political system and prevent attacks on it, especially in the face of what many people are going to view as a polarized court, there is a question of whether he'll inch toward the center as a voice of moderation and to prevent sustained attacks on the Supreme Court. Because even though the court has been right of center in the past, it has issued an even balance of significant liberal and significant conservative rulings, such that any criticism or attacks on the court's legitimacy or authority are, for the most part, short-lived, because if a conservative gets a ruling they can't stand today, next year, or tomorrow, they may get a ruling that they love. So that keeps the court in a protected position where they're not under attack all the time. But a polarized court that produces a conservative onslaught of conservative policymaking could generate more sustained attacks on the court and its rulings, to which Chief Justice Roberts may say, hey, I need to be the voice of moderation on this court and in an effort to protect its legitimacy.
Brendan Bartels, Associate Professor of Political Science at George Washington University. A day after Mexican President-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador's landslide election victory Sunday, he and President Donald Trump spoke by phone. Trump, a frequent critic of Mexico, came away from that conversation upbeat about the prospect of getting along despite trade and border tensions.
We talked about border security, we talked about trade, we talked about NAFTA, we talked about a separate deal, just Mexico and the United States. We had a lot of good conversation. I think the relationship would be a very good one. We'll see what happens, but I really do believe it's going to be a very good one.
In a tweet Monday, López Obrador, who takes office December 1st, said he proposed a comprehensive plan to create jobs that will reduce the flow of illegal immigration into the U.S. and enhance security as an alternative to Trump's planned border wall. The president-elect told interviewers he does not want to fight the U.S., but find ways to cooperate. However, Rice University political science professor Mark Jones, who also chairs the school's Latin American studies, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he foresees a more conflictual than consensual relationship in the years ahead.
President Trump and President-elect López Obrador are very similar in the respect that they're both populist, and they both tend to see trade as a zero-sum game, where if one country wins, the other country loses. Therefore, we're likely to see a lot of conflict over trade, over border issues, over immigration. But unlike the current Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, who's been a lame duck as well as has suffered from low approval ratings, López Obrador is going to take the presidency with a record popular mandate, as well as a style that's going to be far more aggressive and far more nationalist than what we've seen during the first year and a half of President Trump's presidency.
After his conversation with Mr. Trump, Mr. López Obrador gave his account of the phone call in a Twitter post, saying he proposed a comprehensive deal to create jobs, lower immigration, and improve security that may shift away from the proposed U.S. border wall. What might he have in mind?
I mean, certainly he wants economic development, with the idea that the more economic development you have in Mexico, the less migration from Mexico to the United States you'll see. He also, I think, wants to help try to resolve Mexico's real serious problem of violence, particularly related to drug cartels. One option, though, that he's likely to pursue, which won't be too popular within the Trump administration, is the legalization of marijuana, as well as amnesty for some drug traffickers.
He's been touted as a leftist. Will he govern from the center or from the left?
He's going to govern from the left. The real question is, does he govern from the center-left, say like Lula da Silva in Brazil, in which case things should be still pretty good for Mexico and it shouldn't lose too much investment? Or does he govern from the far-left, like Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner in Argentina or Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, in which case we're likely to see investors flee and the Mexican economy collapse?
And how do you anticipate U.S.-Mexico relations going forward?
Until December, things are likely to be pretty calm. But once López Obrador actually takes office, I think we're in for some conflictual relations, at least at the presidential level and at the media level. So it wouldn't surprise me that come December or January of 2019 that we see some verbal exchanges, perhaps a little hostile, between President Trump and then President López Obrador, simply because if Trump attacks Mexico, says anything negative about Mexico, or proposes something with which López Obrador doesn't agree, he's likely to fire back with both guns blazing, not turn the other cheek like the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto, has tended to do.
Mark Jones of Rice University. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. When it comes to immigration, U.S. lawmakers have strong opposing views on the topic. The U.S. Attorney General even quoted the Bible as a reason for tougher immigration policies. Even though the Bible is where leaders within the Christian faith find answers, their views on immigration are just as diverse. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
In the city of angels, how Christians worship God is as diverse as their background and their views on immigration.
I have family that are not documented too, so it's a personal thing for me.
Lovi Longomba was born in Kenya of Congolese parents. He is the pastor of a non-denominational Protestant church made up of immigrants from around the world.
I think that what people we need to do is to find ways to help those who are in need in ways that actually it protects the people in the country also. I think it's not wise to try to save the world while your own house is drowning.
Longomba says the U.S. needs to have a better way of screening people who want to enter the country.
That's why the Bible talks about discernment, the ability to know, okay, who is this? What is it really that they want? You know, because you can be compassionate in a foolish way.
In the Byzantine Latino quarter of Los Angeles, immigrants from Latin America and Greece worship in neighboring churches.
I'm a legal immigrant from Greece with my family. We waited 3 years, and we were sponsored here. This is ages ago. And so we came through the process. It was difficult.
John Bacchus, a Greek Orthodox priest, sees a distinction between legal and illegal immigrants.
You hear people saying we're against immigrants. No. Many of our congregation are immigrants. The point being is that they need to be legal immigrants.
Bacchus says without laws, there would be anarchy.
Is Christian love and compassion meaning abdicating some order, some control? Jesus said to love your neighbor, but he wasn't meaning someone from 3,000 miles away. He was talking in the context of the tribal unit.
But Francisco Garcia, an Episcopal priest and the son of an undocumented immigrant from Mexico, says the U.S. can and should help everyone in need.
As a nation, we could be that place that really does say, welcome, and we will do everything that we can to welcome you and to help you, because I think it's our humanity. We need to sort of cooperate amongst nations, but with the spirit and the ethic of understanding why people migrate.
Garcia does not like the terms legal and illegal immigration.
I don't necessarily make those distinctions that people make, because I understand that it is very difficult. You know, people like to say, well, you got to get in line, you got to do this, and if you just followed the right pathways, you would get this. That works for a small percentage of people. In reality, for most, it doesn't work.
Longomba says the answer to the immigration question is to view the issue from a different perspective.
Putting yourself in your neighbor's shoe is the greatest answer to a lot of the things that we are going through, because there will be a true sense of patience, there will be a true sense of understanding.
And with the understanding that people's views on immigration are largely dependent on their own personal experience. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
That is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The terrorist group ISIS is no longer the threat it used to be. Though it may be diminished, ISIS is far from defeated. As it loses ground in the Middle East, its fighters disperse to cause trouble all over the world, particularly in Muslim countries. ISIS has not limited itself to Iraq and Syria, and therefore neither have we, said Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, Brett McGurk, at a recent coalition meeting. This meeting itself is an indication of our ongoing commitment to finish the job in Iraq and Syria and ensure that ISIS cannot regenerate elsewhere, particularly on the African continent. In Syria, ISIS retains just 2% of the territory it once held. At that time, nearly 7.7 million people were living under ISIS. They were generating about $1 billion every year, and their expansion looked to be unchecked, said Special Envoy McGurk. And on May 1st, Syrian Democratic Forces resumed offensive operations against those last bits of territory. They are ensuring that ISIS remnants have no escape as we accelerate operations into these remaining strongholds. In Iraq, the fight is over, but the ISIS threat remains. Here, too, stabilization is the key. To date, nearly 4 million displaced Iraqis have returned to their homes in areas that were once held by ISIS. Nonetheless, stabilization projects must continue so that the 2 million Iraqis who are still displaced can return home. Finally, in Africa, the coalition is working with partners to support their efforts to deny space to ISIS and other extremist groups. The coalition will continue to work to close their facilitation networks and transit routes running through Libya, Sudan, and the Maghreb. We are committed not to quick wins, but to the enduring defeat of ISIS. An enduring defeat means more than simply the collapse of the so-called caliphate in Iraq and Syria. It means a holistic defeat in the ideological and media space, combating foreign fighters as they move around the globe, uprooting financial networks, and supporting local forces, military and police, to defend their homelands, said Special Envoy McGurk. We are as proud as we can be of the successes in Iraq and Syria.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.